I want to start by thanking all of you for inviting me back to continue this conversation about the global climate crisis and what our Christian response should be to it. I want to ask you a favor. If you're at one of the tables or nearby, there are some free surveys that I'd like you to fill out at the beginning here. I'm going to use the information to make the next couple of weeks as useful as possible for all of you. So you have some pencils and a single sheet of paper. It's a very quick thing to fill out. Now, I wanted to start this morning by just sharing with you for a moment how I came to be here and why I'm doing this. So in the summer of 2016, I was winding down a software startup that just wasn't going to take off when a friend of mine invited me to join a fellowship program that's designed to help people become more effective environmental philanthropists. And I used that opportunity to do a really deep dive into climate change. It was something that I understood to be a really important environmental problem, but I just didn't understand it all that well and wanted to learn more about it. So during that fellowship, I focused my studies by reading a lot of the science from the IPCC, the Union of Concerned Scientists, the National Academy of Sciences. I interviewed researchers at the UW, I talked to policy experts, and I spent some time with technology entrepreneurs that are developing solutions that can help us address the global climate crisis. And after all of that, I was alarmed. I was alarmed because I had just wildly underestimated, and I like to think of myself as being informed, but I had wildly underestimated both how severe and how urgent this problem was. And while I learned that we have most of the solutions we need right now to address this crisis, and more are coming, I also learned that we're just not yet putting them to work fast enough and a big enough scale to avert catastrophic changes in the future. So with that, I kind of came to the realization that this problem represents a threat to the future well-being of my children. And when our new administration started taking us in the opposite direction, away from addressing this problem, I just felt like I couldn't do anything else but focus all my time, energy, and resources on it. So then the challenge was, well, how do you stop global warming? What can I do about it? 3 years later now, I've been working and investing in companies that have solutions. And that's been very encouraging. I've been working with the University of Washington's Carbon Leadership Forum, which is trying to address the large and growing problem of emissions related to building materials and construction. Mm-hmm. And then I've also been advocating for putting a price on the pollution associated with burning fossil fuels at the level of our federal government. And what I want to do in the next couple of sessions here is just share with you what I've learned so that you all can form a collective response as a faith community to the crisis of global warming. So now I'm going to make an assumption, since this is intended to be kind of a continuation of the conversation we started in the spring. I'm going to make an assumption that we all generally have a shared understanding that global warming is happening now, that it's due primarily to burning of fossil fuels at a massive scale since the onset of the Industrial Revolution. A total of about 1.6 trillion tons of carbon dioxide has been put into our atmosphere where it stays for 1,000 years. And that if we don't change course, there are vast portions of our planet that will become uninhabitable for future generations. So I'm going to take that assumption. If anybody has questions about the science related to climate change, I'm happy to point you in the direction of materials and information that may be useful to you. Just come on up afterwards and we can talk about that. But today I want to talk about solutions. That's kind of where we left it off in the spring. And I want to start just by sharing with you that the basic things we need to do to move away from the burning of fossil fuels as the basis for the energy system that powers our global economy are pretty well understood. And they boil down to these six things. So I just want to talk about them for a moment. The first is to reduce energy waste. We have a lot of it just because we haven't been paying attention And the facts are that compared to Germany, America burns, uses per capita almost twice as much energy. Compared to Japan, we use fully twice as much energy. And compared to China, per capita, we use over three times as much energy, despite the fact that a lot of the manufacturing in China is very energy intensive on foods that they produce. The second thing we've got to do is to make sure that we generate electricity entirely from clean fuel sources. And since we talked in the spring, I'm pleased to announce that we now have a plan in Washington to make all our electricity generated by clean fuels will be carbon neutral by 2030, and there won't be any fossil fuels left to power our electrical grid by 2040. And I think we can accomplish it sooner, too, and that may just happen as a natural course. So we, in this region, have an electrical grid that's already 75% clean because of all our abundant hydropower resources. For the country as a whole, it's two-thirds of the fuel for electricity generation is still fossil fuels, coal and gas. Another thing we need to do then as we clean up our electrical grid is just take all sorts of uses of energy and move them from fossil fuels to electricity. And I'm talking about heating and cooling our buildings and the hot water we use in them. I'm talking about our light vehicles in particular and a lot of applications in industry, even things that require significant amounts of heat and industrial processes could all be powered by electricity. Now, there are some uses that are going to be hard because they require very high levels of energy density, and liquid fuels are much more dense in the amount of energy they provide than, for example, a lithium-ion battery. So for those uses, we've got to develop alternative fuels, most likely biofuels. And I'm talking about aviation, maritime shipping, and some heavier industry applications. Another very important thing we need to do, as I referenced a moment ago, is use materials, especially in buildings, that aren't very carbon intensive. This is probably not well understood, but if cement were a country, it would be the third largest emitter on the planet, because cement, and this is true for steel as well, and some other metals, is not only takes a lot of energy to make, it also actually releases carbon dioxide as the limestone breaks down in those kilns when it's fired to 1,400 degrees centigrade. And those emissions are just vented into the atmosphere today. So we need to figure out ways to create concrete that are much lower carbon, and we have them, and we're improving them all the time. Steel, there are now methods for making steel that have no emissions associated with them. They're still very early, but they're very promising. And then, of course, in this region, we know we have a lot of room to use more wood in buildings. And again, there's been big changes even since we spoke in March. The building codes now allow a lot more construction of what are called mass timber buildings up to taller levels. Finally, and this one is just, this is a God-given tool that we have, our natural carbon sinks have tremendous capacity to help us solve this problem. And here I'm talking about our fields and our forests. They are capable of doing a lot more than they presently are to safely store carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, either in plant matter or in the soil. So if we pursue all of these solutions in parallel, we have the capability to wean our economy off of fossil fuels. The question I'm sure that's running through everybody's minds is, well, how much would all this cost? I'm just going to tell you, we can do this, but how much will it cost? And for this, I'm going to lean heavily here on some econometric analysis that some colleagues of mine commissioned recently, a deep decarbonization pathway study that looked at what it would take just in this region. And their estimate was that we could get to having almost all the fossil fuels emissioned out of our economy in this region by 2050 for about 1% of our economic output. That would be the price. And that is kind of hard to get your number around, your head around concepts like gross domestic product. But think of it this way. For when we're during the Iraq War, which I would argue was largely fought over and control of fossil fuel resources, we spent 1% of GDP at the national level on that fight. And you know, in World War II, the country was spending 40% of its economic output on the battle against totalitarianism. Now, for this challenge, not only is it not really that expensive, but it may actually be significantly less costly than that and could save us money. And the reason it could save us money is that the health consequences for many people of breathing air that has, you know, the emissions of fossil fuels in it is pretty significant. And none of those savings were accounted for in this analysis. So in general, I would just conclude by saying that we know what we need to do. We have every reason to believe that it's both achievable and affordable. So before we proceed, I want to just spend the remaining time we have this morning doing kind of a quick review of some of the most significant solutions that we have, just so they're top of mind for all of us as we, for our next couple of sessions. So before I do that, I just wanted to see if anybody had any, you know, pressing questions about this list of things that we need to accomplish to make this big transition. Okay, well, with that,
remind us again who or where it is that has come up with this list and why we think it's reliable.
Okay, so this is effectively the consensus opinion of all the scientists, technologists that have looked at this problem over a number of years now. There have been teams sponsored by the UN. There have been teams of economists and statisticians and mathematicians and scientists who've done this kind of modeling for the globe, for individual countries. California did it at their level, and now it's been done here. So there's a pretty big body of work that's gone on and doing sophisticated modeling of what we can do and what the most efficient and effective way is to transition our economy off of fossil fuels in the coming decades. Is that helpful? So, and by the way, that there's a citation that the study that I'm talking about is from the Clean Energy Transition Institute called Meeting the Challenge of Our Time. And they have a lot of information that you can read. It's pretty short and pretty easy to digest. So one of the solutions that is a real fundamental part, I think, of any rapid change is going to be putting fees on the pollution associated with burning fossil fuels. And we talked about this briefly in the spring, and I'll just remind, for those of you who weren't here, we actually now have in Congress, this is a change since the spring, a particular piece of legislation that implements this policy. It's called the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. And you can all look it up and read it. It's H.R. 763 on the sites for Congress that have bill information. But just to refresh your memory, there are three major parts to this. The first part is you put fees on fossil fuels where they come into the economy. That would be at ports and wellheads and pipelines. Then you take all of those fees and you turn around and you give back to households. And that would be on a per capita basis. So we would all receive a dividend check on a quarterly or monthly basis associated with the revenues that came from those fees. And then to protect businesses who have to compete with goods that come from countries that may not have fees on carbon pollution, we would adjust the fees at the border, sort of tariff, and we could do it in either direction. And my personal hope for this particular policy is it would be a strong incentive for all those countries that want to do business with the United States to have that kind of policy in their own hands, because if we're going to collect the money and decide what to do with it, they might as well collect it and decide what to do with it in their country instead. But I think it would be a really good way to get us moving forward, because it will unleash an awful lot of innovation that today it's just sort of bottled up because the costs of all the pollution associated with fossil fuels aren't charged anyway. We just vent it all into the atmosphere. The other thing I want to emphasize about this policy is that recent polling on it suggests that all voters, Republican, Democrat, once they've had this explained to them, are supportive. And in particular, even on amongst Republicans, the under 40, 75% are in favor of this kind of policy. So there is a lot of room for us to come together as a country around this policy. And this is not the only one. There are other things, too, that people largely agree on. So that's one really important sort of bedrock solution that we need to put in place to really make good progress. Another one is in our buildings. And I, you know, you guys have made a lot of progress here in your buildings. You've been, Kurt's been doing a lot to make sort of changes that will reduce the energy use of the St. Andrews facilities. And the kinds of things that they've been doing here are the kinds of things we need to be doing more of everywhere in our economy. Now, you know, buildings are big and costly and hard to change in some ways, but there are, if we take a comprehensive approach, we can make a lot of progress. And by a comprehensive approach, I'm talking about these basic things. First is measuring rigorously, you know, what the energy consumption is for our homes and our factories and our office buildings. Second is publishing that information so that buyers, whether you're leasing an office or buying a home, have full information about the energy use of that structure. The third is coming up with ways to finance improvements. Because one of the big challenges, of course, is that if you don't know how long you're going to be in a house, and if you're in an office and you don't control what's done there, then you don't really have the incentive to make the kind of changes that are needed. And then the final one is that for new buildings, we need to just make sure that as we construct new buildings, they're as efficient as possible. And I'm pleased to report that we are making progress on all fronts, and we have tremendous room for improvement in the energy efficiency of our buildings. There are now what they call commercial benchmarking policies in place in many large cities in the United States, and especially also in Europe and other countries. And now many cities are starting, like, for example, New York, they're starting to set targets and requiring that as you sell a building or at just a certain point in time, you bring it up to a level of energy efficiency that is specified by that target. The other thing that's been done is a lot of that information is publicly available now. We don't really have this yet for homes. It is something that's being pioneered in a few places, like Portland has a policy. And up on the right there, you'll see a little kind of like a scorecard, sort of like the MPG ratings that you see on cars when you go to buy a car. You can, in Portland, if you sell a home, you need to get an assessment done, and that assessment will give you a score for the building and also a list of things you can do to improve the energy efficiency of that building. And that's been in place for about 18 months now. It's going very smoothly. They've done thousands of these, and it's starting to get information in the hands of consumers. But that's really the only place. The other questions here about that?
Oh, I had actually a question on the financing. So I remember when you last did this series, one of the things that you mentioned that was difficult, particularly in the state of Washington, was around the financing aspect. And like if you get solar panels on your house and you take that out on like a 25-year sort of payment plan or loan, when you sell the house, you're not legally allowed to transfer that debt, even though you're not going to get any benefit from it. And so that, I know certain companies have arrangements where they do that, but again, it comes down to, you know, payment plans over the course of 25 years. Has there been any movement on that?
There has been. Okay. So thank you for that question. That's actually a direct setup for what we're talking about now, which is there's a little logo in the bottom right of that slide that says PACE, Property Assessed Clean Energy. And there are now, my numbers even are a little dated here, most of the states in the United States now have authorized PACE programs. And in the places where they've been in place the longest, they've unleashed a tremendous amount of investment in buildings. The The PACE legislation does exactly what you talked about. It enables the lien to be placed on the tax bill, so it stays with the building. So the benefits to these kind of changes accrue over many years, and that way if the owners change, the owner who is leaving is not responsible for the loan. The new incoming owner is responsible for the payments associated with that. And that just makes it easier for people to justify doing the kinds of investments that even if they think they might not use the house for a long time. So that is a solution that's working real well. And it, in this legislative session, Davina Duer of Bothell has introduced a commercial PACE legislation that would also cover things like seismic upgrades. You know, we have quite a bit of risk in this area of certain buildings, especially brick ones that in an earthquake wouldn't do very well. And retrofitting those is expensive, and this PACE legislation would help finance those kinds of improvements. So hopefully that'll become law here. We don't yet have it for homes. In California, there's been, over the past 4 or 5 years, over $5 billion of investment in solar panels and energy efficiency and more efficient hot water heaters and water savings equipment as a result of PACE. Now, lastly, I just want to talk about new buildings. And in this area, we definitely have the tools we need now to put up new buildings that are extremely energy efficient and in many cases might be able to supply all their own energy. Just depends where in the country that building is located. So the good news on that front is that if we just continue to upgrade our codes, we can put out new buildings that are there's no significant price premium associated with this construction, and it actually saves money over time on utilities. So we're making good progress on that front, but there's a lot of room for improvement. Now, the most important thing for this transition is that we have alternative sources of energy that don't have the emissions that fossil fuels have. And on that front, I'm pleased to report that the quiet miracle that's happened over the past decade, where solar and wind energy have dropped dramatically in price, is continuing. And solar dropped now over 90% in cost in the past 10 years, and wind about 70%, and both are now significantly cheaper than either coal or gas as a fuel source for making electricity. And if you were, for example, to assign some of the costs associated with the pollution that comes from burning coal or gas to this, they would all be off charts. And the good news here is that it now will save us money to replace coal plants with solar or wind. And to in the future, in the next couple of years, it will also make sense for us to replace gas plants as well. To actually, instead of continuing to operate the ones we have, to stop operating them and build new ones that are based on renewable energy. So the economics have now reached an inflection point, which is really important for this transition. And I want to emphasize, this is an unsubsidized cost. This is, you can go look up this study done by an investment bank called Lazard. They do it every year, where they look at these unsubsidized costs. The other really big change that we need to be able to put a renewable fuel everywhere in our electrical system is storage. Because, you know, obviously the sun isn't always shining and the wind isn't always blowing, although usually if you look at a big enough area, it's common for somewhere there's we have the ability, if we can transmit it from place to place, we have a lot of energy from the sun and from the wind. We've had a similar change occur with lithium-ion batteries over the past decade. Even more of a drop in the price of storing electricity. And that continues. And the other really interesting thing that's happening right now is that while there are alternative chemistries for electrochemical storage that are being brought to market that are made from materials that are more abundant than lithium. I'm an investor in two companies, one of which has a system based on iron, and another one that's based on zinc. And both are relatively abundant, and all of them have They can be deconstructed when they're at the end and reconstructed, so they have a very environmentally sound profile. So a lot of good progress there, and it's now actually, I think the big change even in the past year is that almost all the utility RFPs for solar come with storage as well now. That's a big change that's happening in many places. Another really hotbed change that I'm sure you all have seen and probably participated in is new forms of getting around. How many people here have an electric bike? I know of at least one. Just one? So electric bikes, they're
going, Mom!
They're a great way to deal with the hills. You get a little power assist when you need it. They're exploding around the world. I mean, there are many places where people never, you know, there are many parts of this world where people don't have cars. Mm-hmm. And they've been getting around on foot primarily. And electric bikes are a great way for them to get around. And they're coming down in price. And you've seen scooters and moped kind of things that are now available with a touch of an ordering application on your phone. Ride sharing services. I'm assuming that most everyone has used Lyft or Uber or something. And they are all making a move to, and I think this will accelerate dramatically, to use electric cars. In fact, there is a bill in the House of Representatives here in Washington right now to, like we did with electric grid, put companies that operate ride sharing services on a schedule to transitioning their fleet to electricity. And I think the other big thing that's really interesting about this change is that I think for many people in a dense urban environment in the future, it just won't make sense to own a car. I mean, it didn't for me when I lived in Boston a long time ago, but I think it will become commonplace for people just to use transportation as a service. When you start linking what you can do with walking, cycling, taxis and mass transit, all controlled by a computer network that can just tell you the best way to get from point A to B, I think you'll find that we have a lot cleaner and affordable and accessible options for getting around. And then there are some interesting innovations that are being worked on. They aren't yet available for prime time, although I would say that the first electric commercial flight has happened recently. I think it was in Canada with a service that a float plane service. They have a short hop, and they have retrofitted some sort of standard planes to use electrical engines with batteries. So that's coming, and there's a lot of development there. And the interesting potential for that is that there are many airports that are underutilized. And you could, for example, get from a place like San Jose to Pasadena without going from San Jose into the big airport of San Francisco, then to LAX, and then trying to get from LAX to Pasadena, which is a long, complicated journey. Because these planes are quiet. They can take off a very short runway, and so it'd be almost like hailing a cab. The other interesting innovation is Hyperloop Rail, which is working its way into through the stages of commercial feasibility. It basically is a system where you have a tube that is under sort of sheltered, it's pressurized so that there's no wind or air resistance inside it. And then you have the rail system is magnetic, so the trains are resting through levitation on magnetic field, and the amount of friction is extremely small, so they can be powered with much less energy. And the expectations are that systems like this could get someone, and I'll use the example of California, from the Bay Area to L.A., in 35 minutes for the price of a bus ticket, when you do it at scale. Now, there's a big cost of getting these things built out, but it's yet another solution that's becoming more available. Now, we talked about switching fuels. This is probably the area where we have the most work to do. And we have a variety of ways to make alternative fuels, none of them right now are can compete strictly on price without a fee on carbon pollution. If I were to put my bet on the one that would be best in the future, it would be microalgae. You know, we can make plant-based fuels, biofuels from all kinds of sources. It's being done from corn, you know, and ethanol is put into gasoline to make it burn more cleanly. But it's a really unsustainable approach because it competes with food production. And it's also just not very efficient. It makes use of really high-value land. The thing about algae is that you can, that's really attractive, is a very high fraction of the actual plant matter is the oil that gets used for producing biofuels, and you can grow it on land that's not arable, so it doesn't compete with food production, and the only inputs it needs are water, and you can use wastewater or salt water, depending on the strain, and then it takes carbon dioxide and fertilizer. So we can, I think we're going to see really significant improvements in our ability to make biofuels out of algae. Just a couple of examples of the innovations that are taking place. Exxon and a company called SGI have developed a new strain that increased the percentage of oil in the algae from 20% to 40%. And then some University of Utah researchers figured out how to extract the oil with a lot faster and with a lot less energy than the existing processes that are used. And then we have a number of companies that are working on ways to cultivate the algae that, and get very high yields with very limited inputs. And then the big next step is to figure out how to make a lot of products out of algae as a raw material. This is just like what, you know, the oil and gas industry has done. Big plants using crude oil as their raw material produce a whole array of products that get used in industry. And recently, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Colorado has done some modeling of what it would take to make similar kinds of biorefineries, and it's very promising. I predict that if we take all of that innovation and combine it with a price on carbon pollution and build like we have in place right now in our house, the low-carbon fuel standard, which require incorporating some of this kind of fuel into regular gasoline, we'll start to scale up this industry, bring down the prices, just like we did for electricity, renewable electricity, and storage. So I think there's a lot of opportunity here as well. And then I just want to talk briefly about the last category of solutions, and that's natural carbon sinks. And I described in our last session the distinction between kind of our conventional agricultural systems used around the world and a much more renewable sort of agriculture, where they call it regenerative agriculture, so with the conventional system, we tend to till the land, we don't use cover crops, and we just may rotate one or two crops like wheat and corn or soy. And that system results in a lot of carbon emissions because we dig up the soil and the biological organisms in it, as a result emit a lot of the carbon that's been stored in the soil. And it also emits a lot of moisture that is lost, or soils become more dried out. And they're also not able to absorb as much water as if they're covered with plants. So that system of agriculture has actually resulted in our soil becoming depleted over time. And we need to build them back up to grow enough food for the growing of the people on our planet. The regenerative systems, in comparison, do very little or no tilling. They have a cover crop in place, or multiple cover crops, in some cases, all the time. And they rotate a lot more crops, because one of the benefits of which is that it fools pests, because they don't have enough time to get adapted to the crop, to one kind of crop, and be very efficient at destroying it. So the result of that system is we can use a lot less fertilizer, a lot less pesticides, and a lot less diesel fuel, and achieve a similar kinds of yields to the current, more chemical system that we use. So that's it. That was a very brief review. I knew we had limited time today, so I wanted to make sure we could get through kind of a survey of the solutions. And what I'd like to do next is have all of you just get together at your tables and talk for a moment about a couple of things. One is, I was just curious if you had new insights and understandings that come from this review. The second thing is whether you have concerns about whether this is really achievable and what those might be. And then the third and probably most important is, what do you think is holding us back? You know, why aren't we moving more quickly to take advantage of these solutions? So I'm going to just let you go, and I'll call you back in a little bit, and we'll wrap up. So I know we've got another service coming up in a few minutes, and I just wanted to capture a little bit of what you discussed at your table. So I'm going to just use the whiteboard for a moment, and I'm going to focus in on the third question. What gets in the way of putting these kind of solutions to work? And I'll go ahead and start with the table after that. Do you want to say something?
Habits.
Laziness.
Old people.
Old people.
Well, I don't know, in the sense of less investment in the future.
Okay. Do you have a black pen?
I don't see one. This is all I'm up here right now. Who else? How about right here?
We said, like, job training costs and just the expense of upfront costs.
Federal government.
Where did that come from? Federal government? Okay. How about anybody else?
It's overwhelming.
So if it, at least it's perceived by many people that it costs more.
Mm-hmm. Well, there definitely is an upfront cost. I mean, even right now, if you're going to buy an electric vehicle, they're cheaper to own long-term, but there is still an upfront cost associated with them that in a couple of years is actually going to come down to the point where they'll be similar or even cheaper than any internal combustion engine car. But yes, there still is an upfront cost. It takes investment. And that's the financing problem, right? I mean, got to be able to get a loan to do stuff like that.
I think it's, you know, what we're working on here is education.
Education.
What they actually do, right? That becomes a huge thing. And then, okay, no, you can't do something yourself. So it's just, what things you can do, just worry about it.
Okay, let me switch gears for a moment. Were there concerns that people thought they had about whether it is really possible or affordable?
It's overwhelming. It's hard to know what's the one thing I can do that's going to make the biggest change. And you start looking, and it's just, you can change every single thing.
Yeah.
But which one makes the difference? Which one makes the most difference?
Okay. We'll keep that in mind.
For example, you can exchange your normal toilet with a low toilet. You can change your light bulbs for more energy efficient light bulbs. You can do little things. So maybe the light bulb costs a little bit more now, it costs less in the future. When you change your refrigerator, get one that's more energy efficient.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have to go out and do everything tomorrow.
So Christine brought up a really important concept that I would ask everybody to think about, and that's replacement cycles. Whenever we have to replace something, let's make sure that we transition it to this, you know, future world that we need, that we keep that in mind. So we're running a lot of time, and I want to wrap up by doing just a little exercise with you all, which is, this might sound a little corny, but I'm going to ask you in a moment to close your eyes and look in your mind's eye, try and picture what I'm going to describe to you. So I'm going to describe a world in which most of these solutions have been put into place. And I would ask all of you now to just close your eyes briefly and take a couple deep breaths and just try and picture what this looks like. So imagine a large city humming with activity, yet the air is pristine and it's very quiet. Freeways and traffic jams have been replaced by electrified smart network transportation systems that combine walking, cycling, autonomous vehicles, and rail systems. Most people live close to where they work and can walk to services that they frequently use. Few people in the city own a car, yet they can easily get wherever they need to go, conveniently and affordably. Most of the parking lots have been converted to community parks. Clusters of multifamily housing made with locally sourced natural materials are surrounded by green spaces in which people are walking, playing, or just sitting and reflecting. Power outages no longer happen because most buildings generate and store all the energy they need. Almost all the food and raw materials used in the city are produced in the same region rather than in other countries. Outside of the city, clusters of versatile small-scale 3D printing plants rebuild items like electronics, vehicle parts, furniture, and carpet tiles from those that are returned to the manufacturer when they wear out. Huge arrays of fans powered by solar or wind energy are removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Some of these are even sited on landfills that are no longer needed due to the transformation to a circular economy. The transition to a more regional supply chain has revitalized rural areas surrounding the city. Family-owned farms have seen a resurgence, and farmers are achieving high yields without chemical fertilizers or pesticides. Rivers and lakes are clean, and fish populations have rebounded and stabilized. Overgrown forests have been thinned to supply building materials for affordable housing. The forests are managed with sustainable practices that support greater diversity of plant and animal life than the monoculture clear-cuts of the past. Thanks to all these changes, extreme fire and drought have become less common recently as the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere has been brought down to safer levels. So you can open your eyes. So I think that's what's possible. It's just up to us to make it happen. So in next week, we will talk a little bit more about the kinds of plans and responses that we can put together as a nation, as individual communities, and then as households. And then after the third session, we'll talk about how we can have productive conversations about climate change with other people. So thank you. I hope you will be able to join me for both.